Welcome, subscribers. We are talking to Michael Tesarion, and I guess you could say that we are continuing in one way or another in the previous program that we did, a two-hour special, where we dived into a lot of movies and symbolism and so forth. But Michael referred to several times regarding the tarot and the symbology connecting with many of these, like the Prisoner, the TV series and so forth. And I think it would be excellent to spend some time on the tarot with Michael. I'm not myself very well versed in the tarot. I know very little about it, but I'm certainly curious about it. And I know that Michael have a background studying the tarot, so we're very fortunate to spend some time with Michael now on this issue. And I've personally gotten the impression that the tarot is something that kind of have come out of the Western world, spawned from it primarily. And I might be wrong on that, but maybe we can kind of begin on that note, Michael. And just let me ask you, do we know how, you know, where rather the tarot actually comes from the start?
Well, of course, that's one of the biggest controversies, you know. And I think that in almost all the subject matter that I personally deal with, whether it's Atlantis or Irish origins or the goings on in Egypt or the movement of races or tribes, and certainly the creation of the divination arts, in order to really, really understand what has really been going on with all of this, we have to now factor in the whole concept of that there were pre-Diluvian civilizations. I mean, you'd think that this would already be known, because you have the Sphinx, you've got the pyramid, you've got, you know, that all that stuff we know about that is just mesmerizing to man. But, you know, it's not just the tarot that's extraordinary, but what about the Baalbek stone, or the Somerset Zodiac?
Yeah.
You know, or the Nazca Lines, or Newgrange in Ireland, or Stonehenge. And now, do you know that they found other Stonehenges at Stonehenge, that the entire region was filled with stone circles and other amazing artifacts like that?
Yeah, buildings around it, houses and stuff like this. Yeah, of course.
Yep. So, you know, so if we look at all of that and still, you know, can't understand that there was a whole developed civilizations before recorded time, then we are not going to have a faintest idea. And that's what my main work is in life. You know, the Irish origins work and certainly the work on Atlantis, is I do not come to any subject now without ever factoring that in.
Yeah.
Because if you don't think about those ages, then I don't claim that you can be a good scientist. I don't believe that you can account for even the origin of the alphabet or the coming of numerical systems. You know, everything that exists. They found land bridges between India and Ceylon recently.
Hmm.
You know, man-made thousands of years ago.
Hmm.
You know, so we've got these anomalies, and the tarot is one of them. So my answer is that they came from the pre-Diluvian civilizations, primarily Lemuria. And the reason why is because the earliest, what would you say, the earliest account or, you know, reference to tarot is Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good that you brought this up, because the earliest reference to the tarot is to the four suits, you know, the wand, the cups, the swords, and the discs.
Sure.
Which we have in modern playing cards, the four suits.
Mm-hmm.
Those are clearly referenced in Gaelic, Irish, ancient Irish mythology. Not just referenced, but they are actually immensely sacred. They're part of the four main treasures of Ireland, no less.
Hmm.
Meaning you don't have any treasures more mystical, more revered to the civilizers of Ireland. So even if you're only dealing in an Irish context, well, then the greatest ever civilizers on Ireland, ever, in the whole history of Ireland, which is the oldest civilization in Europe, stretching thousands and thousands of years back, the greatest people who lived on that island had no greater treasures, Henrik, than the suits of the tarot. Than what, you know, the cup, the chalice, the cauldron, and they had the lance, which represents the sword, represents the wand. And then they had the sword, you know, and then they had the four symbols. So,
sure.
But here's the interesting thing: those groups, and this has been, you know, in people's face for years. The group that held these artifacts as being sacred, that tribe, said that they came from four destroyed islands in the West.
Hmm.
So get this, they make it very clear in their own legends, or at least the legends that were written down, like, you know, the monks who wrote this stuff down were like journalists. You know, they had learned the history of Ireland, and many of them wrote it down, and many of them wrote it down accurately. Some did not, and some, you know, but it's not about accuracy or not. It's about the fact that these were well-known legends. So even though you find them in, you know, writings of Christian monks, that doesn't matter. The fact is that, you know, Irish people knew these legends. And in one of the legends, they say that the great Gaelic tribe that held these artifacts sacred came from four islands that had been destroyed in the famous, you know, cataclysm, the deluge. Like all the people of the world, they talked also about that they lived and they were high priests, they had high civilizations, and those civilizations were destroyed. And the names of those civilizations is Phalius, Murius, Gorius, and Phineus. Now, if you study that list, you will find that one of the islands of the ancient Irish was called Murius. Murius. Get it?
Yeah, sure.
Lemuria.
Yeah.
Because the letter L, just like any French person knows, and anybody who studied the French language knows that the letter L was put on the beginning of a word often to represent the.
Yeah, sure.
Right? Like you know, today.
Le bombe,
and,
yeah.
And you have that same concept in, you know, so-called Celtic languages where you have O'Farrell Muck. You know, McAllister, the Muck.
Okay, yeah.
And did you know that even in Egyptian languages, the letter H always represented the at the beginning of a word.
Okay.
And this is important because if you study words like Hebrew, right, you're going to need to know that because suddenly a whole other thing jumps out here.
Sure.
Where the H is silent, it's mostly like a prefix.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so again, words are very important to understand. So the Lemuria was really Muria. Well, hello, you find that very term in Murias, which is the ancestors of the Gaels, the ancestors of the Irish. So now we can link up a bunch of three very, very interesting things that shatter what we know about history. One is that there's ancient continents that sank beneath the waves. That's pretty revolutionary enough. The name of one of them was Lemuria or Murias. From that island came the ancestors of the ancient Irish who were incredibly magically endowed. And then to answer your question all the way round, and they brought with them the prototypes for the tarot.
So these the four suits or the four symbols that you talked to, do you think that these are individual, you know, for the four islands, these their kind of signia or emblem?
Yes, they were the insignia of the four kings of the four islands. Who were known as Lu, Dagda, Nada, and the Manan and MacLir. And if you really get, we don't want to get into the whole story of Celtic Ireland, but Manan and MacLir, whom the Isle of Man is named after, and who Shakespeare's King Lear is based on, Manan and MacLir is considered even an older god than that. He's even considered older than the Gaelic gods, so he's a very, very primordial aboriginal god of the sea. But yes, bearing that in mind, they would say that those artifacts, the cauldron, which belonged to a god called the Dagda, who's very similar to Dagon, or, you know, of the Canaanites. Because the Canaanites and the Phoenicians are Irish.
Yeah, exactly. That's.
I mean, let's just say that straight out. So they're Dagon, or they're, you know, they're fish god. It's all based on the same idea. Then you have the stone of Fal, which belonged to Manan and MacLir, a magical crystal, a magical stone that had certain spiritual properties or significance, very much like the Shiva people use the lingam today. You know, but the cult of the stone is just, you know, incredible. I mean, what do you got all over the so-called Celtic world? There's nothing but these standing stones and stones. You know, stuff like that.
Absolutely.
So the idea of the stone being a symbol of kingship, representing the polar axis of the earth, and, you know, also being sort of like stones were used very much like acupuncture needles would be used on a human body. These stones were there to help the Mother Earth, you know, generate energy and to also preserve sacred energy. Then you have the lance of Lu, the sun god, who's known to the Romans as Lugos and to the Welsh as Lu. You know, and London, because one of his other names was Lud, L-L-U-D in Welsh, becomes the foundation of London. So London is Lu's town. Dawn, meaning, you know, hill, and Lu. And by the way, Lu's temple in London, you know what stands on it right now? It's St. Paul's Cathedral.
Oh, really?
Christian sites are always built over ancient pagan sites. And so Lu, the sun god of the Celts, his main center at near the Fleet River, which used to be near a river, is now St. Paul's Cathedral standing on it. You know, and isn't it interesting that even during the Blitz, when the Germans were bombing the whole of London, Paul's Cathedral basically was kind of unscathed.
It was, huh?
Yeah, because there's a vortex there, you know.
Oh my God.
And then you have the sword of the High King of Ireland. The High King of Ireland, he's buried up in Derry, and Derry is in Northern Ireland, and it's based on the word, you know, Dwar or Dru, Derry, which meant the Druids, men of the oak.
Okay.
So, and the sword was actually called Retaliator. And that sword is the prototype of all swords that conquer evil. The next one being, of course, Excalibur.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But Excalibur, you know, or even in Lord of the Rings, where you have the famous cult of the swords and the fact that they glow when evil is around.
Sure, yeah.
And these swords cannot be destroyed by evil. This is all from from Irish mythology, in which the sword of King Nada was called Retaliator. You know, and Nada, one of the other pronunciations of his name was Nua, just like Noah. And his story is the same, that he survived the deluge, came in specially made boats, and they found, you know, Ireland. They came to Erie, which was called Ari or Erie at that time, named after the goddess. And that's what it is. So then you find that. So later on, when you find the symbols of the tarot in Egypt and everything, see, to me, as a Celtic scholar, an Irish scholar who's trying to very much show the ancient connections between Ireland and Egypt, the tarot is very important in this connection because you do find the tarot coming up more traditionally in Egypt.
Okay.
Any references to that? But then when you know that it was first in Ireland, there's your connection between Ireland and Egypt, because how did they get, they must have had commerce between each other to know about it.
Yeah, sure. Huh. So, I mean, let's take the, what's it called, the weight, the deck I'm thinking of. The
Rider-Waite?
Yeah, exactly, Rider-Waite. I mean, this is like, I guess, a modern kind of, they have collected based this on the ancient tarot. I mean, do you know when this is from, like the 70s, 80s or something?
The Rider-Waite?
Yeah.
Oh, the Rider-Waite, no, that was based on, you know, that is a production of the people who were basically involved in an order called the Order of the Golden Dawn.
Oh, okay. Oh,
Yeah, the Rider-Waite would not, it didn't have, see, the man who is basically responsible for everything we have, the tarot today, was a man called Samuel Liddell, or MacGregor Mathers, the head of the Order of the Golden Dawn.
Oh, okay,
We would not even be talking about tarot today, or at the very least, we wouldn't be talking about anything that resembled an esoteric deck without his work. Now, he formed an order called the Order of the Golden Dawn, and it was A.E. Waite, the creator of the Waite deck, was a member of that order.
Okay, yeah. So.
And he drew, and see, MacGregor Mathers made it absolutely strict, you know, kind of rule that in the Golden Dawn you would study the tarot, and he had compiled a master dossier on the sacred esoteric meanings of the tarot, and so important that, you know, that document, for instance, my work could not exist without it. You know, my understandings of the tarot, my online mystery school, you know, 90% of what I'm working with the tarot is this Golden Dawn system, born out of the incredible researches of MacGregor Mathers.
Okay, yeah.
Now, he had this dossier, which he called Book T. And all occultists know about Book T. This was the book tarot that he gave to initiates of the Golden Dawn. Of course, when Waite got that, he liked it, he studied it, he continued his researches in the tarot. And it was really MacGregor Mathers who should have been the creator of the physical deck, since he was the master of it. But the one strange omission is that even though he wrote on the deck and explained every nuance, you know, of its magical significance or whatever, he never actually created one physically. He never drew one. So Waite and these people have got the, you know, the fame of putting the deck together, but the Rider-Waite deck is basically, you know, the Golden Dawn MacGregor Mathers deck.
Okay,
that's the right way to look at it, because everything that he had discovered about the tarot is encoded into it. Now, even though they put it together and they created it, it had a few flaws, right? It had a few flaws, that, because, of course, everything, nothing is perfect in this world, right? So even though it was 98% perfect, there was a couple of things, you know, that needed changes. And then comes into the story, the notorious figure, Aleister Crowley.
Sure, yeah.
Who also had read Book T. He was a member of the Order of the Golden Dawn. The thing is that he was an exceptional genius, and he rose very quickly within the ranks.
Yeah, yeah.
Almost overnight to become very, very senior. Because he had tremendous, you know, personal power and ability magically. So he had discovered immediately that there was something wrong with the gender dichotomy within the tarot, because the tarot features... a part of the tarot is the court cards, which feature male and female characters. And he noticed that there was an imbalance there. So his deck equalizes it. So the masculine and feminine cards are equalized, both in name and symbolism. So again, a few changes like that, you know, and, you know, with the 1800s, we had a, by the time of the 20th century, we had two perfectly, you know, stunning and brilliant and highly beautiful decks that did, in fact, encompass, you know, the ancient traditions. Because the one thing about people in the occult who keep knowledge alive is they don't mess with it. You know, yeah, it gets messed with now in our 20th century media-sized junk scholarship world. Everything gets boulderized. And the tarot certainly has suffered throughout the centuries. But on the whole, you see, people who are keepers of ancient knowledge tend to keep it very preserved. So the tarot could last. The secrets of the tarot were rediscovered because, you know, people tended to not mess with this stuff. And a great mind like MacGregor Mathers, you know, could put together, he dusted it off, he got rid of all the rubbish elements that the French occultists had put onto it. The French occultists were absolutely, you know, responsible in the 1800s for just talking so much rubbish about the tarot. They didn't really understand what it was about. And so in just a short period of time under their hands, more damage was done to the meaning of the tarot than it ever had been done in about 1,000 years.
Okay.
So MacGregor Mathers coming in, you see, and purifying it of all those French elements, basically, you know, added together with the knowledge that he had accumulated over 30 years of study, you know, brought this thing out to be absolutely amazing. So people can, you know, find this tarot in shops now. It's sold over the counter. You know, lots of books deal with it. I certainly recommend it as one of the decks for my students on the way on the mystery school, you know.
Excellent. Yeah, because, you know, this is, I don't know if there is a connection here, but again, as I said, it seems to be like the kind of a Western Western world, spawned from the Western world, the tarot, and at least developed in the Western world. And this might be a kind of difficult concept to get around in an easy way, but I kind of see connect the tarot with, you know, with, let's say that the, if we talk about the cathedrals, for example, in Europe, the medieval period, and if we get into eschatology and stuff like this, I kind of see a connection between the tarot, who kind of deals in one sense in a, in, you know, the symbology that can be found, for instance, within the cathedrals, can be found within the tarot also, and that these two actually, in some sense, kind of connect. Would you agree on that at all?
Oh yeah, unquestionably. But where that, a lot of that comes directly from the tarot, and a lot of it comes just from the fact that anyone who is a really deep researcher or student or initiate into the, you know, symbolism, is going to use or draw upon very similar archive. It's just that the tarot is a very master chapter within the whole symbolic archive, because symbolism is a huge subject.
Yeah.
There's both sacred and profane symbolism. You know, not everything is, you know, it's like Freud was saying, not every cigar is a phallic symbol, you know. So it's symbolism is a big subject. The arcane mystery tradition within the in the subject of symbolism is the tarot, so you're going to see that the deeper researchers, the people who really know what they're doing, are going to refer to that. They're going to refer to it, and the decoding of what these symbols mean is very important. You know, I've spent my whole life looking at it. I'm never going to come to the bottom of it, of what these symbols mean, because you can't come to the end of what a symbolism means. Symbols change as we change. But when it comes to the fact that it is a Western tradition, I have no problem in ever, you know, accepting that, because I'm a person who literally believes that all cultural elements of civilization came from the West. So it's, you know, Egyptian, first of all, we've already spoken that it came from Ireland, but even if you go by the Egyptian idea, I also consider Egypt in many ways, certainly from a religious standpoint, a theological standpoint, to be the roots of what we call the Western magical tradition. So when, because it's not India, it's not China, it's not, you know, Indonesia, and those places, you know, don't have the tarot archetypes. The tarot archetypes are more clearly seen in Italy and in Egypt, and also then, as I said, in Ireland. So, and they speak to a Western consciousness. They speak to an archetypal Western sort of understanding. I mean, that's pretty obvious in some of the decks where you have death. You know, that's, again, a big problem that man had in the 1300s, you know. His concepts of plague and death. So the card, obviously, is a medieval rendition of man's understanding of death. I don't know, let's think of some others. You know, you have Mat, card number 11. justice, you know, that's a very common theme, and that clearly represents the goddess Maat of Egypt. But you don't even have to speculate on that. They've actually found the symbols, you know. I mean, they literally have, they know that the symbols, just like they found zodiacs on the ceilings of different temples in Egypt, so they know absolutely conclusively that the tarot archetypes, almost identical to the modern tarot, existed within, you know, Egyptian culture. And if people go to my main website, Taroscopes, the whole story is right there. People can, you know, get into that.
You know,
if you want to. So tarot and numerology and astrology and Kabbalah, which is not Jewish. Kabbalah goes back to, the again, the old mystery schools of Egypt. If you understand that the Jews were pharaohs in Egypt, which is a whole other discussion, but if you accept that, then, of course, it is Jewish. Ergo, the Jewish are Egyptian, but let's leave that aside for now. The idea is that, yes, these are part of the Western magical tradition, not because they came from Egypt with the gypsies and moved west, but because they were always in the West in the beginning. This is what it's all about. And so I stress in my work that people need to really start using this again. You know, how can you be a Western person looking for God, looking for spirituality, looking for psychic hygiene, and looking for the mysteries of the universe and strengthening your inner being and, you know, developing yourself as a... How can you possibly manage to do that without the right spanner and the right toolkit? Well, what are we thinking here? You know, that you're going to fix the you know, you're going to go and fix the space shuttle with a freaking, you know...
with a wrench.
A hammer and a chisel or something?
Exactly.
This is the brain. Then we look around and find that we're finding spiritually destitute, morally leprous people walking around. Let's face it. The world, man is in a most egregious spiritual and moral state. I've said this from day one, you know. I think in a couple of weeks we're going to upload to YouTube, you know, or to my website, some of the earliest interviews I ever did on TV. You know, they're like, you know, they're from like a late 90s or whatever. You know, they're interesting. I want people to see them. But, you know, I look back at that and go, my God, do you know that I was harping on the same thing? Don't stop. It's like, you know, we are in a very, very severe state.
Yeah, we are.
And, you know, you can't rehardwire. Psychologists have come up with a blank. You see, the doctors, the psychologists, they can only treat the problem. They, you know, a good psychologist, of course, can do more than that, but there's not too many good psychologists around. So the most of the people out there that are called psychiatrists, psychologists, and, of course, a lot of these new age spin doctors, they don't really know how to solve the problem. They have a general idea at best. Well, we can, I can improve upon that substantially. There's a thing called the Western magical tradition. Never heard of that? No, but they've heard of Christianity, and they've heard of Gnosticism, and they dabble in the Essenes, and people are dabbling in black magic, and they're dabbling in blinking, you know, whatever from the East. Hare Krishnaism and Hinduism and all this sort of patriarchal, you know, misogynist, total nonsense, in my opinion, you know, the slavery of the human race. When they've not finished with one slavery, they're jumping to another kind of slavery. There's nothing spiritual about any religion in India. You know, the Shiva stuff is the earliest, and if you track it back early enough, then you got something spiritual. But believe me, there's very few people understand what Shiva was really about and what it means to live that kind of life. They'd be pretty shocked if they found out. And most of the Shiva worshippers in the world haven't the faintest idea what Shaivism really is. You know, it's a very, very different kind of life that is based on catabolism and deconstruction and dying to your own lie, you know. So we're into a whole different setup there, which is not found in the world today. But that, at least, is pure. But you have versions of it amongst the Druids. You have versions of it amongst the Scandinavians. What do you think that whole saga of Odin sacrificing himself on the tree of life is? You know, going into the underworld, right? I mean, we're talking Shivaism big time. It's a concept that was all over the world. It's a shamanic principle. But leaving that shamanic tradition aside, most people in the West are, you know, seeking for anything to fulfill that void. And here are four arts of unbelievable antiquity that were tailor-made for, you know, the development of consciousness. Kabbalah, you know the mystery behind that, what that is? No, the only people I've heard of Kabbalah is when Madonna opened some sort of Kabbalah school. Then they heard about it. Make some T-shirts. You know, then they've heard about Kabbalah. My God, do you know what this thing is? How the, and these arts have been used by the very people controlling your life. So that if people have only heard about these subjects because they've been on some right-wing Christian website and then they have a negative opinion of it, you know, well, I'm saying, hang on a minute, just think for a moment. Those Christian websites may be quite correct when they say that these arts are being used by the, you know, the demonic... mind-controlling elites of the world. Yes, that's true, they are. But that doesn't mean that those arts are themselves in any way dark or negative. They're being used by people who don't have any light of their own.
Exactly, yeah. And, I mean, again, that is kind of the... I got this a little bit concept around, you know, when I was thinking about... We were speaking about an early show we did in regards to... And you, of course, have gone into this in very detail in Subversive Use of Symbolism DVD, of course, but the fact that the ones who are, so to speak, cornering the market of occult stuff is like the marketing people, and even including the military in that sense, that they are diving into, you know, a remote viewing and more esoteric occult knowledge to kind of... basically, I guess, to again corner the market. They gotta you know, elaborate on all potential threats and ideas and so forth, and they have been the one who have kind of dived into those areas, but we are standing still from the outside looking in, and just, you know, either we're dismissing it as an evil, you know, act or something, but still we're not interested in understanding it because we are dismissing it, basically.
That's right. You've got double-headed eagles, you've got Maltese crosses. These things appear on the stones of the Picts in Scotland, ancient symbols. They appear on the very first Sumerian, carvings.
Mm.
The symbol of the cross, the Latin cross, is found on Phoenician goddesses. You've got, you only have to go to Vatican City to find out if symbolism has any meaning. Where do you think the Knights Templars and the Knights of Malta all have their headquarters?
Exactly.
Where do you think the Tomb of the Stuarts, the mausoleum to their death, is? It's not in Ireland where they ruled, it's in Rome.
Yeah, it is.
Go to Washington, D.C. What does shape of the Pentagon look like to you? You know, you've got owls' heads. You've got 22 zodiacs.
Yeah.
Look at any average commercial or rock video, if you can stand it. They're so hideous. They're loaded with occult symbolism.
Yeah.
This is finally starting to come out. You know, it was probably very hard to kickstart this because we're very only recently a literate culture. This is what we've got to understand.
Yeah.
And getting into these more esoteric matters is you know, taboo for people. You should see the anti, you know, web, you know, emails that I get from people who just totally want to, you know, rant at me for being into this kind of subject and telling me it's all bunk.
Mm,
you know,
yeah.
But I studied it. You haven't. You don't know what you're talking about. You're an
exactly.
idiot.
Yeah.
But the only thing you can do is tell me in writing that I'm wrong.
Mm. Hm.
But yet, you know, the people who are even using language... The person, I guarantee you that half the people who are writing to me, you know, and always will lambast what I'm doing, is wearing some Nike t-shirt or some, you know, Raiders hat or whatever. You know, I've had this happen.
Mm-hmm.
There they are, brainwashed to the nines, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's unbelievable how much this stuff permeates into people's minds. And, of course, as soon as you push that button and try to say, look, there's an entire cult language happening here, that ties back into the old, you see, you're not part of a tribe anymore. But your archetypal mind is. Your archetypal mind is longing for those things that once gave your life meaning.
Yeah, yeah.
But the media takes that out of you and sells it to you back. As you say, rightly, yes, in the DVD that we do on symbolism, there's a very elaborate explanation of how the theft has taken place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you've got to know what's happening, how you've been raped and mutilated by a media in order to find its more pure form. Because if they're using those powers on you, then it's because they know they work.
You know,
they know that red is the color that most stimulates the female mind, for instance, red.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so they're going to put that on clothes. You need to know it. You know, people need to know this to understand certain things. And there's a whole language of color, you know.
Absolutely, yeah, certainly.
And when somebody comes to me and they're wearing a particular color, like especially close to their skin, like T-shirt, the color that is closest to the skin that a person is wearing is the absolute sign of what they're going through at that particular time, or tells you something about that person personality-wise, the language of color.
Hmm.
You know, and that's not just me knowing that subject, something I've dreamed up. Madison Avenue knows about it. The top designers in the world are absolutely adept at knowing this, so that when they're doing their fashions, you see, and choosing their colors and choosing their palette, they're fully aware of what colors to choose and what color combinations, not just color itself, but combinations. So if somebody's wearing pink, close to their skin, what does that mean as opposed to a certain color of green? And then you find that there's many kinds of green. There's many spectrums of blue. You know, what happens if somebody's wearing a brown, you know? Psychology behind all of this.
Do you have any, you know, examples in that sense?
No, because this is stuff I keep on the Mystery School for members only.
Oh, okay, sure.
I hate
to
be pedantic about it.
No,
I do have a closed area.
Sure.
I am very cautious about, you know, because people have paid a lot of money to come into the mystery school.
Absolutely.
And
no
they deserve
problem.
To have that area of information utterly, you know, hermetically sealed to them. Otherwise, it's ludicrous.
I totally understand. No, no
you know,
problem.
They don't want the teacher going around telling everybody stuff for free. It's the way it works. If people don't understand that, I apologize in advance, but that's just the way it is.
No problem. We totally understand. This is very interesting. One thing that comes to mind regarding, symbolism and so forth, and tying it back to ancient times, of course, is I was reading a while ago an article about a dude up here in Sweden in the 15th century. He was called Johannes Boreas, and this is kind of like the Swedish John Dee, basically.
Right.
It was like a combination between Francis Bacon and John Dee, basically. He was an occultist into, helping developing the language up here in Sweden and so forth. And this guy was totally involved in rune scripture, and he was into, dragging out. He expressed it that he was actually looking for links between the Hebrew language and the old runes, because he suggested that there was a hint in all languages today that goes back to what he called the root language, that, of course, he tied it together with biblical scripture and so forth, the Tower of Babel and stuff like this. But again, it kind of very interesting to pick up on this. And I guess that this is kind of, again, something that we need to stress and kind of expressed that idea that there actually might be a link between all of these, traditions and even in regards to the first language and I don't know how we can tie all of this together into back to the tarot and so forth, but do you think that there was an original language that we all in some level have a memory of?
Yeah, it was Gaelic is very close to it, and so are the Norse languages.
Mm-hmm.
The runes, it's not that there was one language per se, it's that there was one archive, one symbolic canon
mm-hmm.
that involved, these are people who did not even refer or relate to language in any shape or form like we do today. Mm-hmm. When you understand that language is a sacred thing, and it's attributable to the god Mercury or to Thoth or to Hearn
mm-hmm.
and Hermes, you deal with language and write the written word in a very different way. Feathers were made into early writing utensils or, into early pens, because the feather was the representation of the goddess Mat.
Hmm.
And they made it as a feather because they said that every man who writes something must have Mat's feather right in front of him to realize that he's guided by Mat. He's guided by justice and by truth when you write words.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
Writing words across in the Western Hemisphere from the right to the left represented the movement of light across the sky. Writing, they said, without writing, without light, without the sun, we couldn't write. So people wrote across the page to mimic the movement of the sun.
Hmm, interesting.
Okay, and then early writing was done on leaves, which is why still you could say the leaf of a book.
Sure, yeah.
Right? And leaves were bunched up in certain different ways also to make codes. So some of the first codes were done by bunching. You'd write stuff on leaves, and then the way you bunched them together also meant it was a certain message as well. So, and of course, the runes are very ancient and elaborate. And the word rune just means source of all knowledge. That's what the word means. It means the secret or the source of all knowledge. And the Rhine River, the River Rhine, that is a take on the word rune. River is also connected a lot to this. In fact, the word Hebrew, as we were talking before, the letter H,
is
often used as the word the. So Hebrew literally meant the Hebrew, or those of the river. the people who are not physical rivers so much, but as the river of knowledge.
Oh,
those who are keepers of the river of knowledge. Now, what was the name of the man you just spoke of, the Swedish scholar?
Johannes Boreas.
Yeah, Boreas, Johannes Boreas.
Yeah.
We'll need to read up that. Maybe we can have some links.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a few articles on him on the website already, but...
Yeah, I read those.
Oh, you did? Okay, yeah, this is quite an interesting guy, and I like the idea to try to connect the idea that we can use basically. I know that Crowley was instrumental in developing, for instance, an English Kabbalah and so forth. But I think that we could, this could be developed, I guess, within all languages of that we got today, basically.
That's right. As long as the original canon or the tenets, the purest tenets, are adhered to.
Mm.
The reason why the English Kabbalah that William Eisen created doesn't work is because he breached.
Hmm.
He was an American guy, and he really didn't know a lot of what he was doing. And he he ignored the work of MacGregor Mathers. I mean, how on earth can anybody work in Kabbalah and the mysteries of the divination arts and then just ignore, you know, what MacGregor Mathers has done when all Western systems are based on his discoveries? And, of course, that then cost William Eisen dearly because his system doesn't work because it turned out to be flawed. But exactly, as long as you keep to the main keys, you know, which my work is very purist, it keeps to the main keys, it doesn't branch out from them at all, then of course you can find this turning up. You know, they found in the Maya, there's the symbols of the tarot are very much there.
But
I was also thinking of that if people are really interested in the history of these ancient languages, the man they need to really get involved with is a guy called Professor L.A. Waddell. People who've read David Icke will be interested, will recognize that name, and it was actually myself that first spoke to David about Waddell. And it was wonderful that he actually did go and continue the research in Waddell, and then he turned up all this Waddell material in Biggest Secret and Children of the Matrix, which is absolutely, I was overjoyed to see that, because we had a conversation in San Jose, actually, when we met once, and I was, you know, telling him, look, man, this is the guy you got to get into, you know, so... It was wonderful that he did. And again, let me emphasize that people also need to research the work of L.A. Waddell, because he was, again, the person who really had a lot to say about the true origins of these words and letters and where they really come from, you know, and get into that. And then, of course, even in the Swedish context, Emanuel Swedenborg. One can't think of Sweden without, you know, thinking of another great mind, you know, who was into so many occult areas. So Swedish people tend to be, you know, against the occult and so forth and so on. And I think to them, I always tell Swedish people, listen, can you just stop for 5 seconds and think, who is the greatest scholar that ever came out of your country that's world renowned, you know, who was totally into the mysteries of the East and also Egypt and stuff like that? Was Swedenborg.
Swedenborg, yeah.
And you may not be into it, but the people who designed the cities in Sweden, they were into it. All right? So
that's
you can
the
go
point.
Back to sleep if you like. But remember when you're walking around Gothenburg and Uppsala and Stockholm, you know, that you're walking around in places that were designed by very erudite people.
Exactly. I mean, again, this is tradition in that sense. I mean, my God, if people are interested in, you know, that we should be, you know, educated in you know, history and stuff like this, I mean, the first thing you should do is study up on occultism and occult aspects of our you know, civilization, basically.
But people have been trained not to. See, people don't have a brain anymore. The brain that is in there is a machine. It's like a silicon chip. It's literally been taken out, torn apart, and reassembled in an absolutely programmed way.
Yeah.
And the programmed person doesn't know that, because part of the programming is not to know that. The person has an idea of reality. And after our shows, remember when we were talking about the people's idea of reality, I got a bunch of emails. People say, can you explain more about that? You know, we don't even know what you mean. So, you know, let's take a few seconds here if I can and just say, think an idea of reality works in your brain in exactly the same way, no different than what you call memory. So I hope that clears it up for people. Because a memory that you have is an idea about something that happened to you. It's not the thing that happened itself. In fact, if you really could go back in time, you might find that, geez, your memory of what happened and the thing itself is like totally not the same. And you know this because your friends who share memories with you might totally say, no, that didn't happen. And this has happened to people a lot. When you try to recount a memory, you know, the time you met, you know, Jack Award in Hawaii and, you know, whatever, and you made this, you know, met this famous actor, and then everybody's going, no, that didn't happen. He wasn't wearing that kind of color, you know. He didn't buy us any drinks or take us to any party or anything like that. You're totally flawed memory. So you have an idea of your memory.
Exactly.
Or you have an idea of what happened in the past, and we call it a memory. Well, that is exactly the same. It's no different. It's exactly what the ego is doing in general. It's just you understand that you have a memory, but the memory is not a real thing. It's an idea about something that happened to you. And so you have that same concept when you're dealing with what we call reality.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, a very big problem. And the more unhygienic and unsharp and unrational, and because remember, the garden of the ego, the garden of the mind, is still, it has reason as some of the flowers, but it also has intuition and instinct. It's fed by many waters. It doesn't work just to, you know, say, I'm super rational, I'm going to be a scientist, you know, I won't deal with emotion. No, the world of the inner ego is like the world that you live in outside of yourself. It requires lots of different kinds of weather. There's many kinds of season. You know, the people who believed only in the intellectual side have learned that just doesn't work. And people people are too overly emotional, that doesn't work. You know, so there's a blending here in order to have a proper climate within your own consciousness.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, just one thing to kind of, I guess, tie back a little bit to the tarot in that sense, because you name the, you know, the four suits and so forth. But one thing that I kind of wanted to address here today also was regarding the regular, you know, the card, the deck that we got for, you know, poker or whatever. The idea that it seems to be expressed a lot also in regarding gaming and so forth, that I've been picked up on. I've been watching a lot of old Bond movies lately, and Ian Fleming always have this, you know, theme where they have the, of course, we have the new movie with the casino, of course, the Casino Royale, but you got always the different card games, you know, the gin and the poker and so forth. Do you think that the gaming cards is a kind of a carry-on tradition, or a kind of a lighter version of the tarot? Is the connection between the two there?
Yeah. In fact, the tarot, if you take away the what's called the major arcana, you're left pretty much with what is the modern playing deck of 52 cards.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
But the reason why the James Bond movies are so, you know, use that casino image a lot is because the character himself is the magician.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's an archetype. The James Bond movies, and I use these when I taught children, and we've used the James Bond motifs a lot in the tutorials that I've done on tarot, because he represents the magician in the tarot. He's a modern rendition of this.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the magician is the juggler, is the gamer, is the person who sort of plays with fate,
mm-hmm.
who's an ambivalent character who has sort of a dark side and a positive side. He's a mercurial, hermetic kind of character, and that's what Bond is very much plays upon, this sort of ingenious, you know, person you just can't kill. And this is emphasized then by him being also brilliant at picking the right card and having luck.
Mm.
He's a very lucky,
yeah, sure,
mercurial, you know, kind of Jupiterian character,
yeah,
who's able to do a lot of sleight of hand. And this comes out of the old Simon Templar, right?
Yeah.
Because, of course, the tie-in is with Roger Moore, who first got, you know, into the saint, which is, again, a slightly esoteric, you know, I wouldn't say heavy esoteric, but it has a certain level of esotericism to it.
Mm, yeah.
And his name was the Templar.
Yeah.
Right? And this connects to, you know, a lot of other usages of words in which the James Bond character, when he's working with an anti-hero and he doesn't want to let who his identity be known, it's very interesting the names that he adopts. For instance, in some of the movies, he's called a Sterling.
Hmm.
Right, which has connections to silver.
Mm-hmm.
And then another cover name for Bond is Sinclair.
Ah, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And of course, one of the other Roger Moore characters in the show that he did with Tony Curtis called The Pretenders, he is actually called Sinclair as well in that.
Hmm.
So you have a lot of Masonic Templar type of stuff.
Yeah.
And it carries over into Bond. And Bond's usage of the roulette wheel, which is a symbol of the Wheel of Fortune in the tarot cards.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole idea of fate and luck and so forth and so on. And in fact, the Bond films are loaded with tarot archetypes. Tarot, I find, turns up in lots and lots of movies, even when you wouldn't first think that it does.
Yeah.
It is being used. It has been used and it is used, because I always maintain that the people in control, the people who are in upper-class setups, who've had upper-class educations, who are privy to knowledge that the ordinary middle-class and working-class person does not even have the faintest idea exists. So talking to them about it is not going to work, because they just don't accept it.
Hmm.
You know, you have to take their head and put it right in there, and then they'll maybe see it. But, you know, we have no right to do that. But nevertheless, I don't care what people think.
Hmm.
In the aristocratic, you know, sphere of influence in this world, occultism plays a very big role.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, and it is huge in what they do, in the timings of what they do, in the clothes they wear, the colors they choose.
Hmm.
I mean, all the way down the line, and, you know, people are really going to have to wake up to this. And of course, then a lot of these movies borrow from that.
Yeah.
They borrow incredibly from that. I wish we could get into all the, you know, the various permutations of just the Bond movies themselves. They're fascinating.
Exactly. You know, also, of course, as I see, it's a very tarot-influenced movie. It's, I watched this again a while back, The Seventh Seal by, you know, Ingmar Bergman.
Well, Bergman, of course, himself was a sort of a mystical type of character in many ways.
Yeah.
You know, I think he was a unique individual who worked in archetypes and definitely put those into his movies, you know.
Yeah.
Those are highly complex films, you know. tremendous respect for him. You know, he's not my favorite or anything like that. I prefer myself Werner Herzog. But Bergman is certainly is up there, you know.
Yeah.
Is a tremendous worker with symbolism. And also, before we jump out of it, the 52 playing cards also work independently with its own mystical archetype. Even if people are not interested in connecting the playing cards to the tarot, they better understand that the roulette wheel is the zodiac, and the little white ball that you throw in, that's the sun. You know, birthday cakes cut into geometric symbols, you know, for every year of your life, and you put the candles on, that's a symbol of the zodiac. You know, the child's game hopscotch is based on the Kabbalistic tree of life. You know, throwing coins into wells is a representation of the suit of coins in the tarot and the suit of cups. And then when you the suit of coins is always connected to prosperity, and the suit of cups is a divine inspiration, and also romantic success. So when you join the two, meaning throw a coin into water, you're combining two very lucky things. So that came down into our society, you see, as having that habit, connecting coins with water. So you know, the designs of our cities, I mean, there's not a thing that we're doing that's not based in some sort of divination. But even if you don't connect the 52 card deck with the tarot, the 52 card deck itself has its own unique properties, one of which I will say, I won't say any more about it, but the 52 card deck contains the exact secrets of how to build a pyramid at Giza. Yeah, the mystery of the pyramid, because everybody's been charging after it, from Buckminster Fuller to, you know, Swallow to Lubitsch, every other, you know, Egyptologist, but of course none of them seem to be able to work out how to build one or what it really was meant to be. That's because the Egyptians didn't write stuff down. They had a penchant for, you know, communicating these teachings in a very right brain archetypal way, in which you had to be pure enough to work it out. So people think the Da Vinci Code is complex. That's baloney. As I told you before, it's not even based on Mother Mary as the wife of Jesus or the Magdalene. That is goes thousands of years before that. The Grail predates. In fact, we were just talking, weren't we, about the Irish cup, the chalice that was brought by the High Gael from Murias. That is the original Holy Grail. There's no mystery about it. It's a Celtic artifact that then had a symbolic representation and took many permutations, and then when the Christians got hold of it, you know, they had this permutation. But the 52-card playing deck, the people who understood how and what the pyramid really is incorporated it into the number of cards, the various symbols, and the various breakdown of the permutations of the 52 playing cards. So, you know, I'll say no more about it because, you know, people can contemplate it, but it's a very sacred and arcane understanding. But that, what I'm trying to say for the benefit of our show is that do not underestimate what appears to be innocuous little games. You know, and little innocuous things like, you know, Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes, it's like, you know,
it's in the details.
So-called trivial. The so-called trivial is the most important thing to observe.
You know, one thing that comes to mind, obviously, of course, is the game of chess also. Again, moving from, you know, in the black and the white, we have 16 white, 16 black, and what is it, 64 white and black, moving on the square. And I mean, again, I guess there is a controversy over, you know, where the game comes from what part of the world, and when it was developed. Do you think that there is any... Could these games have been handed down to humanity in that sense that they are kind of learn us, you know, stuff about ourselves if we watch these things carefully enough?
Oh, they're eternal. These are, you know, it's really wrong to say, you know, that they're invented by such and such a group. All you can do is find out the earliest usage of chess. I mean, it's again, believe it or not, is Irish. Remember the god Lugh we were talking about? Well, there was a move in chess called Lugh's Enclosure. And it comes from Irish mythology, in which the god Lugh, in order to prove his skills, his merits, because in Gaelic his name actually meant master of all the arts. And so the tribe that he joined, you know, he was part of, kind of held him to that. They wanted him to prove it. And one of the things that they did was play a game of chess. So here's a reference to the game of chess, 3,000 years B.C., if not more. And in fact, they claim that when Lugh was playing chess with his rival, he actually invented a new move that was called, from that moment on, Lugh's Enclosure. And anyone who studied the game of chess knows that, Lugh's Enclosure. Well, wait a minute, that's Lugh, by the way, not Lugh from the 20th century, you know, or you know, Lu of the Mafia. This is Lu, the Celtic sun god from 3,000 years ago. So we're talking chess existed back then. And the idea that, you know, the 64, you know, squares is connected to the codons of the DNA and whatnot. I Ching, it has the number 64. You know, there's a lot of symbolism there.
Sure.
And this beautiful idea of ignorance and knowledge, black and white, night and day, you know, the black and white. So again, very simple archetypal principles, which contain untold knowledge, untold, unbelievable information.
Yeah.
And it will never end, you know. There'll never be a limit to what people can discover and find out. What are the pieces on the chessboard really representing, you know?
Exactly.
It's just fascinating that.
It is it's very fascinating. You know, one thing I also wanted to kind of touch upon a little bit is I kind of began on the note on the cathedrals and so forth. And I don't know if you picked up on this too, but there seems to be a fascination with and this might be because I've got a one-sided view of it, but it seems to be a very, again, I connect this very much with eschatology and the kind of a doom scenario in that sense. If we, you know, follow again the through the Middle Ages, you know, we had the bubonic plague, and that kind of time period seems to be very, you know, oriented around the death card or the Saturnian brotherhood, I guess, in that sense. But I mean, do you think that the kind of, if we were to follow, for example, Catholicism, that doctrine, do you think that there is a, at least in the higher up of the priestarchy, kind of an idea or a concept that it someday must have, you know, must come to an end or die or, you know, the doom or the end of days in order to kind of survive? It have to kind of renew itself, I guess. Do you think that that idea could be incorporated down into Catholicism?
No, but I think the opposite. See, they may verbally say that, that they believe in renewal, but as a matter of fact, the whole problem with Catholicism and religion of that kind in general is that it's anti-ending. It doesn't have anything to do with, you know, catharsis and true eschatology. It uses that as a fear mechanism to get people to think that their way or their world, the normative world, may be threatened by, you know, some nebulous demonic force or nature, you know, whatever. But you see, it doesn't embody the Shivite understanding of catharsis and catabolic work. It's purely anabolic, and that's what then becomes very fossilized about it. That's what creates this whole, you know, monstrous idea of progress, as if in your one life, you know, that's what you're meant to be dedicated to. It's just plugging into the matrix to create progress, leaving your own needs and your own desires behind. Or the whole religious idea that, you know, a man 2,000 years ago is still saving your soul today. And this whole, you know, continual repetition, recapitulation, the heavy-duty traditionalism of it all, which is very oppressive. You know, this is shown in the tarot cards in number 5, card number 5, you know, with the Hierophant. So it's more in unorthodox teachings, you know. I mean, the Druids, you see, were like that. The Druids, you know, there was no question of you being involved in anything sacred unless you were very much a person who understood the meaning of death. And the meaning of transition and sacrifice, you know, in a true way. These are just used today, you know, obviously they're part of the palette of what is used, but, you know, it's not really real. It's like you believe this and then you just freewheel for the rest of the lot. You know, you just freewheel down. And the more conservative, the more restricted, this is what people want, because people are deeply threatened by the mysteries of the universe, by the fact that there's nature does not respond to your good or bad deeds. You know, it seems ambivalent. That you can be a person doing all this good. I mean, really, even truthfully, a really decent, good person might question, hang on, I do good, and I'm told that doing good is very important in life, but I don't actually get anything from the universe for doing good. The moon, the sun, the nature does not treat me any differently. I don't get better looking, I don't get more women, I don't get more rich, I don't get more famous. In fact, quite the opposite. The more good you do in this world, the more, you know, in the shit you can end up, as we well know. So it's like somebody in the subconscious might be going, hey, you know, what is this thing about, you know, that there's no real, true, distinguishing reward mechanism built into the universe that responds to a person doing good? Well, the obvious answer to that is that if there was, then everybody would do good, wouldn't you? If it was like, you know, Moses tapping the rock, and suddenly your food and your water and all your goodies came out of the universe, out of the fountain of the universe, because you responded by doing good deeds, then every mug would be doing good deeds. But the fact of that's perplexing to the human mind is that there is no response. So humanity, being troubled with that, has then decided to respond very, very positively to good deeds. Okay, so humanity, realizing that there was no inherent prejudice towards good deeds, decided that, listen, we better then do it. We better make an agreement in society, in culture, that when somebody does a good deed, you very much show a lot of, you know, reciprocity to that. That's where we get even the word thank you that's so abused today. I mean, everyone says thank you. Where do you think that came from? Or smile. When somebody smiles, or at Christmas when we give gifts or do good, and then, you know, if this person's done good for you, you know, you are obligated to rush across town and do good for that person. That person is now a friend, you know. Where does that all come from? That all comes from the idea that we better respond to the good deeds and make it a cultural idiom to teach children that when you do something good, we're going to respond positively. That's good. We want you to do that. Because if you don't, there could be untold havoc let loose. Because it's very trepidatious. It's not a pleasant feeling to feel that you're in a universe which does not respond to your good deeds. Now, the psychopathy comes in when a family or a society doesn't reciprocate the good deeds of, you know, somebody. I think people can get some examples of what I'm saying here, but they may have noticed it in their own family unit. It's very, very, very dangerous when you do not respond very positively. You don't want to overdo it like some idiots, you know, like politically correct nonsense. But you want a really authentic response to people who do good. And if you don't do that with children, you're dicing with death. It may not happen, but it could happen that person then starts to think, why should I do good at all? What the hell? You know, the universe doesn't respond to me, and these people don't. In fact, I'm even penalized for doing good things. They talk me down, or they bully me at school for being good. So you're going to have a couple of responses to that. You're going to have people who then will, you know, become very hardline Christians because they believe that's the only place to go where that ethic of responding to good is honored, meaning that they'll go around other people who believe that. Or you have the other kind of person who turns off being good because they realize it's a fraud, it's a fake. And this is what you find when you interview a lot of murderers and serial killers and people who have no conscience. Yeah, but blame that. You know, let's look into the parents and what happened there. How come these people were not responding when this child obviously probably did do some good deeds? And if it was penalized for doing that. So a lot of the things that are happening in our society today, you know, they go back to some primeval understandings. And the church knows that. So the church, like society, says, on the whole, we will make it very clear that good deeds and our Jesus is a person who did a lot of good deeds. He did it even without being responded to. And you must do the same thing. And I can understand that. That's very healthy. I have no problem with that. Because, again, if you send a contrary message, you can cause untold pain and suffering in people's lives. You can create distortion mentally and psychically in people if you don't.
Interesting. Yeah, very true, I think. Yeah. One thing that comes to mind in regards to speaking of the church and kind of tying this back, I guess, together with the first show that we did here today, speaking about the Da Vinci Code and so forth, do you think that there is a possibility that even though the Mary legend is very ancient, of course, but people around today don't know that, so do you think that this the Da Vinci Code, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and so forth, could be this effort to renew the church, the Catholic Church, in that sense that they know that people soon enough are going to demand, you know, something new, or people are beginning to look away from the classical Jesus story and they want something more. Do you think that could be the case here?
Yeah, I don't think that the people in the Vatican City, you know, and the various secret societies that are affiliated with them, ever really have ever had true trepidation. I don't think they panic. I mean, you got to understand, these are people who've outlived the Bolshevik Revolution. They've outlived and dealt with Hitler. They've crushed the, you know, Egyptians, Babylonians, Irish. So I think they're very, very confident people. When you get into their, you know, into their conference rooms, you know. I think they deal very mechanically with the problems that arise in front of them. But I don't think they're worried. You know, their system is they're here to stay, basically. That's the way they think. However, they operate like you would any general. You always plan for the worst. There's a very interesting movie that was made years ago in the 70s. People might remember it. It's with Burt Lancaster. It's called Scorpio.
Mm-hmm.
It's about assassins. Ostensibly, the movie is just about this whole thing with assassins, sort of like CIA guys.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite actors is in it. That's why I always like this film, is Alain Delon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from France. I think he's still going, isn't he?
No idea.
Yeah, he's a producer, actor. I always liked him a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He's in it. And there's Burt Lancaster and also the great Paul Scofield.
Okay.
Who's one of the greatest actors ever lived, in my opinion. And they're in this sort of, you know, I don't know, it's kind of cheesy kind of movie in a way, but it's actually quite a good film. It's like a sort of James Bond intrigue, you know, John le Carré type of film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the end of that movie, when they're discussing the CIA, they basically say that down the room, there's this line, there's a great line in the movie, goes down the room, you know, from the main office of the main head man, mm-hmm. the CIA, is another room that they play a game. And then very much like the 3 Days of the Condor, there's this description in this film, Scorpio, about the game and how it's played.
Hmm.
And it's very much in it, they bring out the idea that this game is played by the winners, and they know they're not going to lose, but they create a rival.
Hmm.
They create rival situations as if they're going to lose. So they mimic reality, and they play the game ahead of time in order to, you know, work with the contingencies. It's the same thing military people do when you're at the military academies, where they study, you know, Hannibal, and they study the various wars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they study the different battles, like the famous Greek battles where the Greeks destroyed the Persians.
Sure.
Can't remember exactly the name of that battle, but there was a fantastic battle, you know, where the Greeks were able to hold off the might of the Persian Empire just by, you know, commanding one little road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so military people will mimic and replay a lot of these periods.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Vatican and the people who control the world do the same thing. They're not really moving from a worry, panic button type situation. And they know that it's very easy to crack the whip, like you're saying, and immediately get people back in. So you create a lot of school shootings on one side. You fund a lot of horror movies, right? Because I do believe that Rosemary's Baby, you know, Eye of the Devil, The Green Door, Eyes Wide Shut, Devil Rides Out, The Devil, A Daughter. You know, let's bring it up more up to the 70s where you've got the slasher movies, all the way through the zombie movies, with few exceptions, but certainly the Freddy movies and the Halloween, Friday the 13th, all those movies, in my opinion, are Jesuit-based.
Hmm.
They're funded strictly and thought out by people involved with the Black Pope and the Jesuits.
Hmm.
Because they're the perfect, remember, it's carrot and the stick. That's the stick.
Okay.
And then by creating utterly traumatic situations in the normal secular world, like school shootings, for instance, which we know involve mind control and so on, it's the perfect way to get people to rush back to the church.
Oh,
in fact,
okay.
It was noted that in certain communities where these school shootings had happened, church attendance was like out of control. From people that you couldn't get into the churches any, you know, they'd lost their faith and nobody was coming, you know, during the 80s and 90s, where people were prosperity possessed. You know, all upwardly mobile, materialistically, just hedonistic.
Yeah.
So the church knows how to respond to that. It creates something demonic and woo, oh my God, our kids are going berserk, what's happening? I guess it must be the devil. People then fall back into that old tradition, the programming, the time of the witch hunts.
Yeah.
I believe there really is a devil. You know, they're not thinking, it's very simple, it's government cover-ups and mind control. Okay, ever heard of that? No. They don't think about that. They think about, oh my God, Satan is loose in our community. We're guilty. You know, we turned off our spiritual, religious community. I guess we got to get back to that. It's only a hair breadth away.
Yeah.
People have been programmed for years. So the Vatican knows, look, just go out there and throw a few bombs around and, you know, create a few Marilyn Mansons and some other kind of negative stuff to affect the kids, and it'll have the perfect response.
Yeah.
That's the carrot, that's the stick.
Huh.
Then they have the carrot by saying, you know, why have you forgotten about us? We have a very pure understanding of religion. Forget all this New Age crap and all this other Satanistic stuff you're into or whatever.
Mm.
You know, come back to Jesus, the symbol of a pure, strong, good-looking, independent, brilliant, genius man who may have been sent from heaven hanging on a cross? Have you any idea how powerful that image is? Go to a church and look at what that symbol represents. And think of it. You know, personify yourself as that person. With nails through his hands, you know? A man, an ordinary man, a good-looking, brilliant, intelligent, divinely inspired, and thoroughly moral human being. I mean, they got a number there. They're selling you something that's heavy-duty powerful.
Yeah, they got him nailed right there
right.
on the cross.
And somebody who'll die for the world, who'll even die for the guy who's hanging beside him, going, forgive me, and he does it. Mm. I mean, you know, they're throwing all the adversarial stuff at the world. This guy's conquered the devil, he's conquered the Roman army, you know, he's climbed out of every type of adversarial thing that can happen. You're dealing with something very, very powerful there.
Mm.
So it's very easy for a human being to displace their own spirituality and go, I believe in that, I believe in that.
Mm.
That man, that God, and everything he represents, and the church that operates in his name, excuse me, that doesn't operate in his name, but, you know, people believe it.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, they believe, I'm going to believe in that. That has a lot of power. And just to, you know, quote-unquote, educate, graduate, indoctrinate you into that, they'll throw a few, you know, Mel Gibson movies out, and they'll throw, you know, oh my God, look at the time in the 1960s with all those, you know, epic films.
Mm.
You know, they work wonders. I love those movies. They're great, you know, but they're very indoctrinating.
Yeah.
You know, people just go, that's what it's all about. And those are designed for young children. And, of course, you know, the young person is not, like in any country, like in the Muslim countries.
Hmm.
The children isn't given 5 minutes to decide whether they want to be Muslims or they want to be Christians. You're bloody told to do that. You're going to be, you know, you're going to be dressed up and put on those robes.
Absolutely.
You're going to be told to read the book and bow here and scrape there. And, you know, today we go to church. You don't have a free choice.
Huh.
You're not told that Muhammad, you know, legitimize rape as a form of punishment for women, and that the 44-year-old Muhammad was already married to, you know, a girl of seven.
Hmm.
Yeah, you're not told that he legitimized, you know, brutal rape of women in order to punish them for their transgressions, and all the other stuff that's right there in the Quran. But people will believe that in the same way that Christians read the Bible and think it's all ever so holy.
Hmm.
They can't even see what's in front of their eyes.
Hmm.
They don't even know that half the book of Revelations was dealing with Caesar Augustus. It wasn't even anything to do with Jesus Christ. That every single term that is ever used for Jesus was only used ever for one man, and that's Caesar Augustus. And if it was ever used for anybody else, it was people who were descended from the Caesars. They can find all the information on, you know, my website.
Hmm.
But, you know, this is, aren't Christians meant to go to Bible school and learn about true history? But you see, like in the Da Vinci Code, he says, you see what your brain wants you to see.
Hmm.
Well, this is what, unfortunately, is happening here. So I'm not against people being Christian. My God, half my mentors are Christian.
Mm, yeah.
The list of my Christian mentors is, like, you know, a long list.
Mm, yeah.
But the thing is, be a Christian because you actually know something, not because you're believing something.
Mm.
You know, and I get a lot of people pretending to be Christians going, but I do know this stuff, and then sending me all this trash that they've written or they've read. It's just rubbish. It's the same old stuff.
Mm.
Belief is rampant within Christianity. Knowledge is at a minimum.
Mm.
And it's the same thing in Muslimism. It's the same thing in Hinduism. So, of course, man has had to turn the page. And look at other things. And then, just like I said, society must reciprocate, you know, the good, and if you don't, you create a demented person. As soon as anyone from a Christian background turns to goddess worship to study it, or into tarot, suddenly it's like, oh my God, you've gone off the ranks, you're evil.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so this is how the church then deals, when you know fine well that the upper echelons of those very organizations are well into all of this stuff.
Yeah.
You don't believe it, just go to Rome and take your camera, okay? Point made. Full stop.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It is like, you know, we are not, in that sense, interested in, you know, many people are not interested in understanding religion. They are interested in devoting themselves to it, rather, so.
And, you know, we can take it one step further and ask a much deeper question, which I know a lot of people don't get it, but, you know, some do. And the point is this, look at what it is inside yourself that makes you so susceptible to that kind of control. That's what we really need to look at. So with one hand, you want to look at what the religion is and whether the religion is true or whether it has, you know, what's it made up of. You want to do that objective study of, say, religion or Christianity, which we do. But you never forget, you don't put consciousness, you know, out of it. You also say, why then would people lend themselves to this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, for instance, why do people go for this religion and not so many others, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole psychological component that we still need to look at.
Hmm.
You know, people, when the Passion of the Christ came out and they were doing these polls, they found that over almost 60% of American people believed the prophecy, that the Bible was prophecy. It really was talking about things that were going to happen.
Hmm.
That's the same old millennial angst stuff, you know,
yeah,
of
sure.
All the ages prior. Here it is still alive and well in America in the modern age.
Hmm.
So, as we say, you may be living in what you think is, you know, modern times, but your consciousness, your psyche, your emotional instinctive needs are still rooted in the very ancient past and can be easily manipulated if you haven't matured and grown emotionally and psychologically. And this, of course, is, again, young, very young, because Freud was only writing this, you know, 100 years ago, 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that, you know, that it's still, people are going to need to get a handle on this, you know, and I just hope that they do, because the leaving consciousness at the door in any field is absolutely scandalous. It doesn't work in science. It ran science aground, and it's certainly not right in religion, and it's certainly not right even in people in their own personal religious quest.
Hmm.
You know, people are going, you know, okay, Michael, you say this and you say that. You know, where am I meant to look for my answers then? Give me some insights. How am I meant to, you know, clean my psyche and do all of these things? As if they want advice, you know. It's like, I don't know. You create your own religion. That's the whole point. I'm trying to get you to create your own understandings. Come to your own personal. But people don't even know what that means. They're so indoctrinated by what others have said, what others have created, what others have thought, that they have no conviction or confidence. And I'm talking about you. You dream it up. You create through your imagination and through what you have in your head. It's a mind and then you have a heart. Create something with that. Create your own worldview. Because that worldview will be, of course, based on elements of what others have done and have written, but it will be something you have created from within yourself. It hasn't been transposed or bought outside and then planted inside.
Exactly.
And even if that philosophy turns out to be very negative in the end, so it turns out to be something that's, you know, not in any way correct, so be it. At least then that's a statement of who you really are. Better to know yourself. Better to know, are you truly a moral and pure person, or are you really some seething maniac?
Yeah, and
man will never know that unless he's given the freedom to really explore himself.
Exactly, and that's that also opens up for the opportunity to change oneself if you discover that you are something that you didn't like or whatever. There is also always the opportunity to develop and learn and to progress as a human being. That's how I see it, anyway.
Exactly, and but even before you get to that, what would happen if it did turn out that you were one of these people that had been an ancient soul who was nothing but a black soul who's still frequenting around here, you know, with playing the mask, to all intents and purposes, looking wonderful on the outside, saying all the right things, belonging to the right religion, you know, not totally conforming, but really inside you're utterly reprehensible. This is something I deal with in the vampiristic stuff I do on vampirism. I don't want to get into it too much in this show, but just for a moment, just imagine that there is somebody that really is, you know, I mean, we have people locked up. I mean, it's, you know, we know about these people, right? The serial killers, the murderers. There are such people who exist who have no good in them whatsoever, period, none. Okay, if you haven't been able to explore yourself and you don't know that you really are one of those people, but you're out there running around with this politically correct idea that you're going to fix the world, do then we understand why the world never gets fixed? In other words, if you're trying to clean a perfectly clean window with an oily rag and then wonder why the window never gets clean, I can give you a very simple answer to that. It's because you are the oily rag. So it's no good to just keep jump-starting people into, oh, we have a responsibility to clean the world. Here, let me give you your rag. Here's your duster and here's your bucket. Let's all go like the frickin' seven dwarves out there to clean the world.
Yeah.
No. The shaman goes, hang on a minute. Who the hell are you?
Yeah.
Let's open your skull and look inside you before we ever hand you the squeegee. Because you may not be somebody who can clean the world. You may be unclean. Yeah. And in fact, by having you as a Judas, as part of the group that might want to clean the world, if even that concept is understandable, you might be doing damage to those that you're working with. So we got a whole bunch of questions here that very much focus on the individual and who they are.
Yeah, indeed.
Now, Christianity is the perfect ruse. Orthodox religion is the perfect way of getting out of looking at that. Because they go, all ye come into the, you know, into the pen. You all come in under Jesus, and he'll take care of it. Because, of course, you're a sinner. We assume that you're a filthy rat. But just because you convert and come over into us, we're going to kind of take care of all of that. And basically, you're given grace. That's what grace means. You don't have it, you're given it. I'm totally against all this nonsense. This is exactly what exonerates the most vile, pernicious, vampiristic, psychically violent human beings that infest this planet. Who are morally degenerate. And I will never bandy words anymore. I'm too old and long in the tooth for this. We are surrounded by people who have no good in them. Merely they know how to act and mimic goodness. Morality is not something that is a bunch of good deeds that you perform in our society. It is a tremendous light that you carry within yourself. A virtue. This is the only English word that can ever, you know, encompass it, is the term virtue. And I'm lucky I know many virtuous, deeply virtuous people. And, you know, I like to seek out those kinds of people. because they're lights into the world. But unfortunately, the rest of people are not quite on that level. And then if we go to what you were just saying, well then, okay, we can speculate about the idea that once a person has looked inside themselves deeply and do find out if they really want to do that homework, it's almost like a non-starter, because if you're really that dark, you're probably not going to want to look at yourself at all. Hmm. You're going to be addicted to all the escapes that stop you looking at who you are.
Hmm.
But just imagine for a moment that you did actually have some sort of contrition at some point, that something that happened in your life dramatically changed your way of thinking about yourself and your way of acting, and of course this has happened. This definitely has happened.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is that potential in the very few people that they might want to change. They might want to go through some sort of, metamorphosis.
Yeah.
And we have to hold that out. We have to hold that out as a potential to happen.
Mm.
But again, it's not going to happen because somebody else finds you out. There's no God looking at your dirty deeds. You know, there's none of that. That's all your own conscience. Your own conscience is the one monitoring you. Your own conscience, if you have one, is the only voice that's trying to, you know, improve your actions.
Hmm.
And so that brings up again the whole question of psychology.
Absolutely.
But I do believe that, you know, people who are wrong, who've done wrong deeds and who are immoral can change, you know.
Hmm.
I don't know, parts of me sometimes think they can't. You know, I'm developing a lot of these ideas. I don't know. People, you know, I'm always hearing about people who have done that, so
yeah.
You have to sort of believe that maybe it is possible. I don't know.
Absolutely. You know, I wanted to mention also, of course, as we began this part on speaking a little bit about the tarot. I wanted to mention for people who want to kind of dive into your work more, just suggest to them to get your DVD on divination and the goddess tradition, where you go, you know, heavily into all of these aspects and very, you know, eloquently go through the different ideas of all of this and the background to all of these ideas. That is one DVD that I really would recommend to people who want to learn more about this stuff.
You see, that's good, because you see, this subject is one of the most, you know, diverse and wide and complicated subjects. So it was very important that I did a DVD that was long and more, you know. Of course, you can never do justice to a subject like this, but at least I wanted to get out of the sound bites.
Mm-hmm.
Really give as much of a panoply of understanding about what all this is about,
mm-hmm.
in order to disperse a lot of the false ideas that concern this,
mm-hmm.
and also to show that if we're looking at solution settings, if we're trying to look at the healthy solutions for where we're going, we're very much going to have to understand this Western magical tradition.
Yeah,
we're very much going to have to clean that oily rag, which is ourself. And you are not going to be able to do that with any other modality that exists, from religion down, unless you're involved with the divination arts. It's simply not possible. The only detergent that exists is, you know, it may only be a help to you. I mean, you may be endowed to be able to work a lot on your own. And, of course, that can happen.
Mm, yeah.
But if you really want the toolkit to learn how to really accelerate that process,
then
you've got to use the ancient archives that were created and put down for that precise purpose, that help mirror who you are, that help give you your wisdom and clear answers about what to do. It's not about being a slave to rituals or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
A certain amount of ritual is involved, but then a certain amount of ritual is involved in making a pizza.
Sure.
you go to the kitchen, you have to perform a certain amount of rules and routines.
Absolutely.
You know, putting on your clothes is a version of ritual. So somebody goes, oh, I don't like all that divination arts, it's too ritualistic.
Huh.
What in your life is not ritualistic?
Yeah.
You want to learn how to play the guitar, you're going to have to learn ritual. Right. A certain amount of whatever ritual means, a certain, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
You just can't. Playing the guitar is not picking up and banging the guitar off the wall. You know, there's certain rules and regulations about how to sit and play the thing, you know. So it's the same thing with divination. But those are not that's not the divination itself.
Yeah.
The divination is what you bring out of yourself. So it's like conversations with yourself. Is working with the divination arts, you're getting into knowledge about other aspects of yourself that you have not known about, nor is anyone going to teach you about, nor is any religion going to reveal to you.
Mm.
So the tarot is a living temple, a living, you know, indescribable mystery school in which you discover more aspects about who you are. Same thing with astrology. What do you think an astrology chart is? It's you. It's a physical template, a microcosmic, you know, example in 3D. Or in 2D, whatever, or who you are. It's not about planets and, you know, protractors and compasses and left brain mathematics.
Hmm.
It's about a discovery, a journey, a mythical journey in which all the heroes have to go through. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're still, like Joseph Campbell said, playing those myths out right now. You're not going to be able to avoid them. And in fact, if you try to avoid them, you're setting up a pathological situation in which you might arrest your development as a spiritual person.
Mm-hmm.
So some guys are emailing me going, oh, it's all bunk. I go, well, I weep for you then, because you are a person who's arrested your own development. That you don't understand that the symbolism and all of these things are important is already the signed, sealed, and delivered statement that you are a half person. And I couldn't trust a person like that. I wouldn't want to know a person like that. Because I look at those people as demented. That which was good enough for the pharaohs, for the kings and the rabbis, the magi, right? And every type of, you know, illuminated, eminent priestarchy that's ever existed. You're going to tell me that what's good enough for them isn't good enough for Joe Blow? Well, he's got his camel T-shirt on, right? And his, you know, Marlboro cigarettes.
Yeah.
And he's going to tell you that symbolism has no meaning as he's opening his box with a pyramid on it and the capstone of the Marlboro box.
Exactly.
Happily telling you as he's lighting one up, it's all bunk, I don't believe in any of that shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, okay, whatever.
Yeah, you know, again, I think that this really, you really nail it, so to speak, in that Origins and Oracles DVD called Divination and the Goddess Tradition. And listen, Michael, we could go on again for hours here. We spent we don't want to steal all of your time here today, but I think this is a perfect kind of time to finish up this interview for now. But again, we will speak again in a month and continue on this theme that we've been, you know, treading on for these last few series that we've done, programs that we've done here together. But again, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. And if you want to mention your website again, do that for us.
Yeah, well, we'll link up, but people can get to, on the tarot, they need to really go to tarotscopes.com.
Yeah.
And they can get to that either by directly or by going by michaeltesarian.com. And they'll find a lot of information there on the tarot and the meanings of the cards. There's also a visual Tarotscopes tour. It's in text and also in visual. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot. I put a lot. It's mostly my main work is working with the divination arts, by the way.
Sure, yeah.
It's, you know, what I've done most in my life, I guess. And to me, it's a very fascinating subject, and it does permeate a lot of other things that I think, you know, I mean, symbolism, the whole symbolism DVD, you know, symbolism and the divination, they all connect.
Absolutely.
It's a very, very interesting subject.
Absolutely.
And if people want to know about the different tools that are being used against them to control their behavior and their attitude, they better realize it's not just a bunch of random symbolism. It's some very choice, very educated occult divination figures who are very, very skilled in this kind of black magic sorcery. There's a difference between magic and sorcery. It's another division that we need to understand. That we're being used, sorcery is being used on us. And the only way that you can counterbalance or dismiss sorcery, which is, of course, is what they show in this fantastic film, Lord of the Rings, is to use magic. And magic is a very different thing than sorcery. What we mostly know in the world is sorcery. And unfortunately, I have to say it, sorcery is being used on us even by those people that, you know, have created and are using the religions of the world. And magic is a very different kind of action.
Pharmacopoeia, that's sorcery right there.
Right.
Even there. Yeah, so again,
yeah, we'll talk more on it in the future.
Absolutely. So, I mean, everybody go visit tarotscopes.com and, of course, check out originsandoracles.com and take a look at those excellent DVDs that Michael got there, Divination and the Goddess Tradition, and, of course, Subversive Use of Symbolism in the Media, etc., etc. Again, Michael, thank you so much for coming on, and we will speak again in a month.
That sounds good.
Thank you so much for being a subscriber. You keep RedIceCreations.com going.